They turn the year into what are called its seasons and change it, bringing about in each season countless transformations. Calms, clear skies, cloud cover, extraordinary violence of winds. Again, they cause rivers to flood and to shrink. They turn plains into marshes and, conversely, dry them out. And they bring about the ebb and flow of the seas, whether receding or returning in their tides. For sometimes broad gulfs of sea, as the water withdraws in the ebb, suddenly become a deep shoreline, and a little later, when the water pours back in, become the deepest of seas, sailed not by small craft, but by ships carrying countless cargoes. And indeed they cause all things on earth, living creatures as well as fruit-bearing plants, to grow and come to their completion, bringing it about that each thing's own nature runs its full course, so that new things bloom and flourish alongside the old, furnishing an unstinting supply to those in need. The bear, indeed said to be the guide of sailors, is made up of seven stars. Gazing upon it, helmsmen have charted the countless pathways of the sea, an incredible feat, undertaking something beyond the ordinary scope of human nature. For by fixing their reckoning on the stars just named, they discovered lands previously unknown, islands, for those who dwell on the mainland, and continents for islanders. For it was fitting that, under the guidance of heaven, purest in substance, the hidden recesses of both land and sea should be revealed to the human race, the creature most beloved by God. In addition to what has been said, the chorus of stars called the Pleiades is also completed in seven, whose risings and settings are the cause of great blessings for all. For when they set, furrows are cut open for sowing, and when they are about to rise, they announce good news of the harvest, and upon rising they rouse rejoicing farmers to gather in their necessities. And these, gladly, store away their provisions for daily use. The sun, too, the great governor of the day, completing two equinoxes each year, in spring and in autumn, the spring equinox in Aries, the autumn equinox in Libra, provides the clearest proof of the God-befitting character of the seventh. For each of the two equinoxes falls in the seventh month, and it is on these occasions that the law has ordained the greatest and most public festivals to be celebrated, since it is at both of these seasons that the produce of the earth is brought to completion. In spring, the crop of grain and of the other sown plants, and in autumn that of the vine and of most of the other tree fruits. Since earthly things depend upon the heavenly by a certain natural sympathy, the principle of the number seven, beginning above, has descended and reached even to us, visiting the race of mortal creatures. Consider first that the part of our soul apart from the ruling faculty is divided sevenfold, into the five senses, the organ of speech, and, in addition to all these, the generative faculty. All of these, like puppets pulled by strings in a marionette show, are worked by the ruling faculty and are now at rest, now in motion, each according to its own appropriate states and movements. Likewise, if one were to examine the body, both its outer and inner parts, one will find seven in each category. The visible parts are these: the head, the chest, the belly, the two hands, the two feet. The parts called the inner organs are the gullet, the heart, the lung, the spleen, the liver, and the two kidneys. Again, the head, the most governing part of a living creature, employs seven organs of greatest necessity: two eyes, two equal organs of hearing, two nostril passages, and a seventh, the mouth, through which occurs, as Plato said, the entrance of mortal things and the exit of imperishable ones. For into it come food and drink, perishable nourishment for a perishable body, while out of it go words, the immortal laws of an immortal soul, by which the life of reason is governed. Now the objects distinguished by the finest of the senses, sight, also share in this number by kind. For the things that are seen are seven: body, extension, shape, size, color, motion, and rest, and beyond these there is nothing else. It also happens that all the modulations of the voice are seven: the acute, the grave, the circumflex, and a fourth, the rough breathing, a fifth, the smooth breathing, a sixth, the long sound, and a seventh, the short. Moreover, it also happens that there are seven kinds of motion: upward, downward, to the right, to the left, forward, backward, and circular, which those who perform the art of dancing display most clearly of all. They also say that the discharges of the body have been made to conform to this number. Through the eyes, tears pour forth; through the nostrils, the purgings from the head; through the mouth, the spittle that is spat out. There are also two receptacles for the discharge of waste, one in front and one behind. A sixth is the outpouring of sweat over the whole body. And a seventh is the most natural emission of seed through the generative organs. Hippocrates, too, who understood nature well, says that it is in the seventh month that both the solidifying of the seed and the shaping of the flesh are strengthened. Again, in women, the flow of the monthly courses is supplied at its most for 7 days. And children in the womb are naturally brought to completion, most paradoxically, in 7 months. For 7-month children are born viable, while 8-month children are, for the most part, unable to survive. And severe illnesses of the body, especially when, from an imbalance of the powers within us, continuous fevers take hold, are resolved most often on the 7th day. For that day judges the contest concerning life, voting for some their preservation, and for others their death. Its power extends not only to the things already mentioned, but also to the finest sciences, grammar, and music. The 7-stringed lyre, corresponding to the choral dance of the planets, produces the celebrated harmonies, and is, one might almost say, the leader of the whole art of instrument making. And among the elements of grammar, the ones called vowels are, fittingly, 7 in number, since they alone can be sounded by themselves, and, when combined with the others, produce articulate speech. For the semivowels they complete by filling what is lacking, making the sounds whole, while the mutes they alter and transform by breathing into them something of their own power, so that what cannot be spoken becomes speakable. For this reason, it seems to me that those who from the beginning assigned names to things, being wise, called the number 7 hepta, from the reverence surrounding it and the dignity that attaches to it. And the Romans, adding the letter S that the Greeks had omitted, make the emphasis still clearer, calling it, more truly to its origin, septum, from what is solemn, as has been said, and revered. These things, and still more, are said and philosophized about the number 7, on account of which it has received the highest honors in nature, and is honored also among the most respected of Greeks and non-Greeks who labor at the mathematical sciences. It has been honored too by Moses, lover of virtue, who inscribed its beauty on the most sacred tablets of the law, and engraved it in the minds of all who were under him, when he commanded that after 6 days, a 7th be kept holy, refraining from the other tasks that pertain to the pursuit and acquisition of a livelihood, and devoting themselves to the one occupation of philosophizing, for the improvement of character and the scrutiny of conscience, which, seated in the soul like a judge who cannot be intimidated when it rebukes, employs at times the sterner threats, at other times the gentler admonitions, threats for what one seems to have done wrong deliberately, admonitions for what was done unintentionally through lack of foresight, so that one may not slip again in the same way. Summing up the making of the cosmos in a brief formula, he says, "This is the book of the generation of heaven and earth, when it came to be, on the day that God made heaven and earth, and every green plant of the field before it came to be upon the earth, and all the grass of the field before it sprang up." Gen 2:4-5. Does he not here plainly set forth the incorporeal and intelligible forms, which turn out to be the seals of the objects perceived by sense? For before the earth turned green, this very thing, greenness, already existed, he says, in the nature of things. And before grass sprang up in the field, there was grass not yet visible. And it is to be supposed that in the case of everything else that the senses judge, the older forms and measures, by which the things that come to be are given their form and measured, existed beforehand. For even though he has not gone through all of them one by one but all together, being as careful as anyone of brevity, nonetheless the few examples given are samples of the nature of the whole, which accomplishes nothing among the objects of sense without an incorporeal model. Continuing the sequence and keeping the connection of what follows with what precedes, he says next, "And a spring rose up from the earth and watered the whole face of the earth." Gen 2:6. Other philosophers say that water in its entirety is one of the 4 elements out of which the world was fashioned. But Moses, with keener eyes, accustomed to observe and grasp even distant things very well, considers the great sea to be the element, a 4th part of the whole, which those who came after him, calling it ocean, suppose the navigable seas among us to possess in the magnitude of their harbors. And he distinguished the sweet, drinkable water from the seawater, assigning it instead to the earth, and taking it to be a part of the earth rather than of the sea. for the reasons stated earlier, so that the earth might be held together as by a bond, its sweet quality uniting it in the manner of glue. For left dry, without moisture seeping through its many crevices and spreading everywhere, it would have fallen apart. But things are held together and persist, some by the power of a unifying breath, others because moisture does not allow them, as they dry out, to crumble into fragments small and large. This is one cause, but another must also be mentioned, one that aims, as it were, at the same target of truth. Nothing born of the earth is naturally composed without moist substance. This is shown by the scattering of seeds, which are either themselves moist, as in the case of animals, or do not germinate without moisture, as is the case with plants. From this, it is clear that the moist substance spoken of must be a part of the earth, which gives birth to all things, just as with women the flow of the monthly courses is said by natural philosophers to be the bodily substance of infants. What is about to be said is not out of tune with what has been said. To every mother nature has given breasts flowing with milk, as the most necessary part, having prepared beforehand nourishment for the one about to be born. And the earth too, it seems, is a mother, which is why the ancients thought fit to call her Demeter, joining together the names of mother and earth. For it is not, as Plato said, that earth imitates woman, but woman imitates earth, earth which the race of poets fittingly calls mother of all, fruit-bearing and all-giving, since she is the cause of the coming to be and continuance of all animals and plants alike. Fittingly then, to earth, the oldest and most fertile of mothers, nature has given the streams of rivers and springs as breasts, so that the plants might be watered and all animals have drink in abundance. After this, he says that God fashioned man, taking dust from the earth, and breathed into his face the breath of life. Gen 2:7. Through this, too, he shows most clearly that there is an enormous difference between the man now fashioned and the one who came into being earlier after the image of God. For the one molded is now a being of sense, already partaking of quality, composed of body and soul, man or woman, mortal by nature. But the one made after the image is a certain form or type or seal, perceptible only to mind, incorporeal, neither male nor female, imperishable by nature. Of the man of sense perception, the particular man, he says that his constitution is composite, made of earthy substance and divine breath. For the body came to be when the craftsman took dust and shaped from it a human form, while the soul came from nothing created at all, but from the Father and ruler of all things. For what he breathed in was nothing other than divine breath, sent out as a colony from that blessed and happy nature for the benefit of our race, so that even if it is mortal in its visible part, it might be made immortal in its invisible part. For this reason, one might properly say that man is a borderland between mortal and immortal nature, sharing in each so far as is necessary, and has come to be mortal and immortal at once, mortal in respect of the body, but immortal in respect of the mind. That first man, the earth-born one, the founder of our whole race, seems to me to have come to be supreme in both soul and body, and to have far surpassed those who came after him in the excellences of both, for he was in truth beautiful and good in the fullest sense. One might establish the beauty of his body from three considerations, of which this is the first. Since the earth had only just appeared, newly formed after the separation of the great mass of water that was called sea, the matter of things that came to be was still unmixed, unadulterated, and pure, and moreover pliable and easy to work, so that what was produced from it was, naturally, faultless. Second, it does not seem that God, in taking dust to fashion this man-shaped statue, took it from any chance part of the earth, but with the utmost care selected the best from the whole, the purest and most thoroughly refined portion of pure matter, which was most suited to the construction. For a kind of house or sacred shrine was being built for the rational soul, which he intended it to carry as a statue-bearer, carries the most godlike of statues. Third, and this admits of no comparison with what has been said, the craftsman was good in every respect, and especially in his knowledge, so that each part of the body had, individually and in itself, its proper measures, and was precisely fitted for harmonious participation in the whole. And along with symmetry, he further molded good flesh and painted a fine complexion, wanting as far as possible, the first man to appear most beautiful. That he was also supreme in soul is plain, for he seems to have used no other model among created things for its construction, but only, as I said, his own reason. This is why he says that man came to be an image and likeness of this, having been breathed into on the face, where the seat of the senses is. Through these the craftsman ensouled the body, and having established reason as king within the ruling faculty, gave it a bodyguard to receive the impressions of colors, sounds, flavors, and odors, and the like, which without sense perception it could not by itself alone apprehend. Now it is necessary that the likeness of a wholly beautiful model be wholly beautiful. But the reason of God is superior even to his own beauty, the beauty found in nature, for it is not adorned with beauty, but is itself the ornament, if the truth be told, more comely than any beauty. Such, then, was the first man, in body and in soul, as it seems to me, surpassing all who now exist and all who existed before us. For our origin is from human beings, but he was fashioned directly by God. And to the extent the maker is superior, to that extent is the thing made superior. For just as that which is in its prime is always better than what is past its prime, whether animal, plant, fruit, or anything else in nature, so it seems that the first man, when he was formed, was the very peak of our whole race, while those who came after did not reach the same peak, each successive generation always receiving dimmer forms and powers. This is a thing I have observed happening in sculpture and painting. Copies fall short of their originals, and what is drawn or modeled from the copies falls short still more, being that much further removed from the source. The magnet stone shows a similar effect. Of the iron rings, the one that touches it is held most powerfully, the one attached to that one less so, and a third hangs from the second, a fourth from the third, a fifth from the fourth, and so on down a long chain, all held together by a single attractive power. Though not in the same degree, for those hanging farthest from the source are always looser, because the pull, growing weaker, can no longer grip as tightly. Something similar seems to have happened to the human race, each generation receiving dimmer powers and qualities of body and soul. We shall speak with perfect truth if we call that founder not only the first man, but also the only citizen of the world. For the world was his house and his city, since no structure had yet been made by hand out of stones and timber. In it, as in a homeland, he dwelt in complete security, free from fear, since he had been deemed worthy of dominion over all things on earth, and all mortal creatures cowered before him and had been taught, or compelled, to obey him as their master, living in the enjoyments that come with a peace unmarred by war, blamelessly. And since every well-governed city has a constitution, it necessarily followed that this citizen of the world made use of the same constitution as the whole world itself. And this is the right reason of nature, which by a more authoritative name is called ordinance, being a divine law, according to which what is fitting and proper has been assigned to each thing. Of this city and constitution, there had to be citizens who existed even before man, and who might justly be called citizens of the great city, having received as their portion to dwell in the greatest enclosure, and having been enrolled in the greatest and most perfect commonwealth. And who could these be but rational and divine natures, some incorporeal and intelligible, others not without bodies, such as the stars turn out to be? Associating and living together with these, he naturally passed his time in unmixed happiness, and being kin to and closely related to the ruler, since much of the divine breath had flowed into him, he was eager in everything he said and did to please his father and king, following in his footsteps along the highways that the virtues cut open, since only to souls that regard likeness to the God who begot them as their goal is it lawful to draw near. Of the first man, then, as he came to be, the beauty of both soul and body, even if far less than the truth of it, has been described, so far as lay within our power. As for his descendants, who share in his form, it is necessary that they preserve, however dim, the marks of their kinship with their forefather. And what is this kinship? Every man, in respect of his mind, is akin to the divine reason, having come into being as a copy, or fragment, or ray of that blessed nature. But in respect of the constitution of his body, he is akin to the whole world, for he is blended out of the same elements, earth, water, air, and fire, each of the elements contributing its appropriate portion toward the completion of a wholly sufficient material, which the craftsman needed to take up in order to fashion this visible image. And beyond all that has been said, he dwells in all these realms as being most his own and most closely related, changing his abode and visiting now one, now another, so that one might most properly say that man is everything, a creature of land, water, air, and sky. For insofar as he lives and walks upon the earth, he is a land creature. Insofar as he dives, swims, and often sails, he is a water creature. Merchants, shipowners, purple fishers, and all who pursue the hunt for shellfish and fish are the clearest proof of this. And insofar as his body is raised aloft, lifted upward from the earth, he might rightly be called a creature of the air, and further, of the heavens, since through sight, the most sovereign of the senses, he draws near to sun and moon and each of the other stars, wandering and fixed alike. Most beautifully, too, did he attach to the first man the assigning of names, Gen 2:19. For this is the work of wisdom and of kingship, and that man was wise, self-taught, having come to be by divine hands, and moreover a king. It is fitting for a ruler to name each of his subjects. And as one would expect, an exceeding power of rule attended that first man, whom God, having fashioned him with care, judged worthy of second place, setting him as his own viceroy and as ruler over all else, since even those born so many generations later, when the race, over the long courses of time, has already grown faint, nonetheless still rule over the irrational animals, guarding, like a torch of rule and dominion passed down from the first man, what has come down to them. He says, then, that God brought all the animals to Adam, wishing to see what names he would give to each, not that he was in doubt, for nothing is unknown to God, but because he knew that he had constituted rational nature in a mortal being as self-moving, so that he himself might have no share in its wrongdoing. He was making trial of him, like a teacher testing a pupil, stirring up the disposition within him and calling him forth to display his own works, so that the namings might come forth spontaneously, neither unfitting nor discordant, but expressing very well the particular natures of the things named. For since the rational nature was still unmixed in the soul, and no weakness or sickness or passion had yet arisen, he received the impressions of bodies and things in their purest form, and made names that hit their mark, aiming very accurately at what was signified, so that the naming and the understanding of their natures occurred together. Thus he excelled in all noble things, arriving at the very furthest limit of human happiness. But since nothing in the realm of becoming is stable, and mortal things necessarily undergo change and alteration, the first man too had to taste some misfortune. The beginning of his culpable life came to be a woman. For as long as he was alone, he was like the world and like God in his solitude, and the characters of each nature were stamped upon his soul, not all of them, but as many as a mortal constitution could contain. But when the woman too had been fashioned, he saw a form akin to his own and a kindred shape, and he was delighted at the sight and came near and embraced her. And she, seeing no living creature more like herself than he, rejoiced and answered him with modesty. Then love arose and, as if gathering into one the two divided parts of a single living creature, joined them together, implanting in each a longing for partnership with the other toward the generation of their like. And this longing also gave birth to bodily pleasure, which is the beginning of wrongdoing and transgression, on account of which men exchange their immortal and blessed life for a mortal one, full of misfortune. While the man was still living a solitary life, before the woman had been formed, there is an account that a garden was planted by God, unlike anything among us, Gen 2:8ff. For our gardens are of lifeless matter, filled with all kinds of trees, some evergreen, for the eye's uninterrupted delight, others coming to bloom and putting forth shoots in the seasons of spring, and some bare cultivated fruit for men, not only for the necessary use of food, but also for the superfluous enjoyment of a luxurious life, while others bear fruit not of that kind, which is of necessity allotted to wild beasts. But in the divine garden it happens that all the plants are ensouled and rational, bearing as their fruit the virtues, and besides these an incorruptible understanding and quickness of mind, by which the noble and the shameful are discerned, and a life free of disease and incorruptibility, and whatever else is of the same kind. These things, it seems to me, are philosophized symbolically rather than literally. For trees bearing life or understanding have never yet appeared on Earth, nor is it likely that they will appear hereafter. Rather, as it seems, by the garden he hints at the ruling faculty of the soul, which is filled, as it were, with countless plant-like opinions. By the tree of life at piety, the greatest of the virtues, through which the soul is made immortal, and by the tree that discerns good and evil at the intermediate practical wisdom by which opposites in nature are distinguished. Having set these boundaries in the soul, he watched like a judge to see toward which it would incline. And when he saw it leaning toward wickedness and neglecting piety and holiness from which immortal life results, he cast it out, as was fitting, and banished it from the garden, giving to the transgressing soul no hope of return thereafter, its faults being incurable and beyond healing. Since the pretext for the deception was itself not a little culpable, and it is not right to pass over it in silence. It is said that in ancient times the venomous, earth-born creeping thing, the serpent, used to utter speech, and that it once approached the wife of the first-formed man and reproached her for her slowness and excessive caution, because she was hesitating and delaying to pick a fruit that was altogether beautiful to see and most sweet to enjoy, and moreover most useful, since by it she would be able to know both good and evil things. And she, without examination, assenting from an unsteady and unsettled judgment, ate of the fruit and gave some to her husband as well. And this at once changed them both from innocence and good character into wickedness. On this account, their father, for the deed deserved wrath, since they had passed by the plant of immortal life, the perfection of virtue, by which they could have enjoyed a long and blessed life, and had chosen instead of that life a mere span of time, ephemeral and mortal, full of misfortune, determined against them the fitting penalties. Now these things are not fictions of myth, in which the tribe of poets and sophists delights, but rather patterns of figures inviting allegorical interpretation, according to the renderings suggested by their underlying meanings. Following a reasonable conjecture, one will say fittingly that the serpent spoken of is a symbol of pleasure. First, because it is a footless creature, fallen prone upon its belly. Second, because it feeds on clods of earth. And third, because it carries venom in its teeth, by which it is its nature to kill those it bites. And the lover of pleasure lacks none of these traits. He can scarcely lift his head, weighed down and dragged low, his neck twisted and his feet tripped by lack of self-control. He does not feed on the heavenly food which wisdom offers, through words and doctrines, to those who love contemplation, but on the food that springs up from the earth according to the yearly seasons, from which come drunkenness and gluttony for delicacies and greediness, which tear open and fan into flame the appetites of the belly and increase them, together with the frenzies below the belly, into ravenous gluttony. He hungers after the labor of bakers and cooks, and, turning his head about to catch the savor of seasoned dishes, longs to partake of their loathsome allure. And whenever he sees a lavishly spread table, he throws himself bodily upon what has been prepared and pours himself out over it, eager to gorge on everything all at once, making his goal not satisfaction, but leaving nothing whatever of what was prepared. For this reason, he carries no less venom in his teeth than the serpent does. For his teeth are the servants and ministers of insatiable greed, cutting and grinding everything meant for eating, delivering it first to the tongue, which judges flavors for approval, and then to the throat. And an unmeasured quantity of food is by nature deadly and venomous, since such quantities cannot be digested, owing to the mass of what keeps entering before what came before has been absorbed. The serpent is said to utter a human voice, because pleasure has countless champions and advocates who have taken up its care and defense, and who are bold enough to teach that mastery over all things is bound up, of things small and great alike, with nothing whatsoever excepted. Rather, the first unions of male and female have pleasure for their guide. Through it procreation and birth come about. And the newborn are by nature drawn first to nothing so much as to pleasure, delighting in it and shrinking from its opposite, pain. This is why the newborn infant wails, suffering pain, as is natural from the chill. For having come from the very warm and fiery place in the womb, in which it dwelt for a long time, it suddenly emerges into the air, a cold and unfamiliar region, and is struck, and its cries provide the clearest evidence of its pain and distress. Every living creature, they say, hastens toward pleasure as its most necessary and most binding end, and man especially so. For the other animals seek it only through taste and the organs of generation, but man pursues it also through the other senses, whatever spectacles or sounds are able to afford delight to ears and eyes. A great many other things besides are said in praise of this passion, and of how it is most proper and most akin to living creatures. But what has now been said suffices as a sample, on account of which the serpent was thought to utter a human voice. For this reason it seems to me that, in the particular laws too, where he wrote what creatures ought to be eaten and what not, he especially praised the one called the serpent fighter, Lev. 11:22, a creeping thing that has legs above its feet, by which it is able to leap from the ground and rise into the air, like the locust tribe. For the serpent fighter, it seems to me, is nothing else than self-mastery, symbolically expressed, waging an unrelenting battle and an implacable war against lack of self-control and pleasure. For self-mastery embraces frugality, contentment with little, and whatever is necessary, holding these especially dear for a modest and dignified life, while the other embraces excess and extravagance, which become causes of softness and dissipation for both soul and body, through which a culpable life, harder than death, comes about for those who are of sound mind. As for its sorceries and deceptions, pleasure does not dare to bring them to the man directly, but to the woman, and through her to him, very fittingly and aptly. For within us the mind holds the place of the man, and sense perception that of the woman. And pleasure meets and consorts first with the senses, through which it also beguiles the ruling mind. For whenever each of the senses is led captive by its charms, delighting in what is offered, sight in the variety of colors and shapes, hearing in melodious sounds, taste in the sweetness of flavors, smell in the fragrance of rising vapors. Having received these gifts, they bring them, like handmaids, to reason their master, bringing persuasion along as an advocate, urging that nothing whatsoever be rejected. And reason, at once enticed, becomes a subject instead of a ruler, a slave instead of a master, an exile instead of a citizen, and mortal instead of immortal. For, in general, one must not fail to recognize that pleasure, being like a courtesan or a wanton woman, longs to find a lover, and seeks out procurers through whom she may hook him. And the senses act as her procurers and matchmakers for the one who loves her. Having easily seduced and won over the mind, they carry inward what appeared outside and report and display it to him, stamping in him the impressions of each thing and producing in him a like affection. For he, resembling wax, receives the impressions conveyed through the senses, by which he apprehends bodies, being unable to do so by himself, as I have already said. The wages of pleasure were discovered at once by those who first became slaves to this harsh and hard-to-cure passion. The woman received violent distresses, the pains of childbirth, and the griefs that follow one upon another throughout the rest of life, especially those concerning children, both in their being born and being raised, in sickness and in health, in good fortune and in bad. And after that, the loss of freedom and subjection to the man who lives with her, whose commands she must of necessity obey. The man, for his part, received toils and hardships and continual sweat in providing life's necessities, and deprivation of the spontaneous goods which the earth had been taught to bear without the skill of farming, and instead a share of unending labors in seeking a livelihood and food, so as not to perish of hunger. For I think that, just as the sun and moon, having once been bidden at the very first creation of the universe to give light forever, keep the divine command for no other reason than that wickedness has been banished far from the bounds of heaven. In the same way the deep and fruitful earth too, without the art and cooperation of farming men, would bear great abundance according to the yearly seasons. But as it is, the ever-flowing springs of God's graces have been checked, since wickedness began to outstrip virtue, so that they might not be bestowed on the unworthy. The human race, then, ought to have been utterly destroyed, if it was to undergo the fitting penalty for its ingratitude toward God, its benefactor and savior. But he, being by nature merciful, took pity and moderated the punishment, allowing the race to continue, yet no longer supplying its food as readily as before, so that men, indulging in the two evils of idleness and satiety, might not transgress and grow insolent. Such, then, is the life of those who at first practiced innocence and simplicity, but afterward preferred wickedness to virtue, a life from which one ought to keep away. Through the account of the creation of the world, just given, he teaches us many other things besides, but five that are the finest and best of all. First, that the divine exists and has being, this against the atheists, of whom some wavered, remaining uncertain about its existence, while others, more audacious still, grew bold enough to declare that it does not exist at all, but is merely spoken of, since men have overshadowed the truth with mythical fictions. Second, that God is one, this against those who introduce the doctrine of many gods, who are not ashamed to transplant from earth to heaven the worst of bad forms of government, mob rule. Third, as has already been said, that the world came into being, this against those who suppose it to be uncreated and eternal, who thereby ascribe nothing more to God. Fourth, that the world too is one, since its maker is also one, who made his work resemble himself in its being unique, and who used up all matter for the generation of the whole. For it would not be a whole unless it had been compacted and composed of the whole of the parts. For there are those who suppose that there are several worlds, and some even that there are infinitely many, infinite and unknowing themselves with regard to the truth, of which it would be good to have knowledge. Fifth, that God also exercises providence over the world. For it is necessary that what has made a thing should always care for what has come into being, according to the laws and ordinances of nature, by which parents too take forethought for their children. He who has learned these things beforehand, not merely by hearsay but by understanding, and has stamped upon his own soul these wondrous and precious forms, that God is and has being, that he who truly is one, that he has made the world, and has made it one, as has been said, having made it resemble himself in its being unique, and that he always exercises providence over what has come into being, such a man will live a blessed and happy life, marked with the doctrines of piety and holiness.